Welcome back to the program. We all know what happens to child celebrities, right? Well, remember the movie The King's Speech and the oldest daughter of the man who would be king? Well, that young girl would herself become the Queen of England at the age of 25 and serve until this very day some 60 years as the second longest-serving English monarch. It seems simple on the one hand. Yet this woman, Queen Elizabeth of England, has been in the public eye for 60-plus years. She became queen when Dwight Eisenhower was president of the United States. Through generations, wars, British governments, and the dramatic changes of the 20th and 21st century. And she has done it all with grace, composure, intelligence, and even only one husband. Regardless of how you view the monarchy, there's certainly a lot we might learn from this remarkable woman. We're going to talk about this today with a guest that has been with us before, and it is my pleasure to have Sally Bedell Smith back on this program. She is the author of best-selling biographies of William Paley, Princess Diana, Jacqueline Kennedy, and Bill and Hillary Clinton. It is my pleasure to welcome Sally Bedell Smith back to this program to talk about Elizabeth the Queen, the life of a modern monarch. Sally Bedell Smith, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Jeff. It's my pleasure.
Great to have you here. One of the things that I suppose is most surprising about looking at the life of Queen Elizabeth is that she really is more modern, as you use in the subtitle, more modern than we think she is. We think of her as being much more removed than we see in the portrait that you paint.
Well, yes, and she has modernized the monarchy really in a very incremental, subtle way, but so much of what I learned about her was surprising was that she has the capacity, she has tolerance, she's open-minded. If somebody presents her with a proposal for changing the way she goes about her business, she will listen very carefully to a well-constructed argument, and she will do it. And this is the way she's been all the way along. She's been far more, you were right that she was raised in an almost Edwardian atmosphere. So it was all the more remarkable to me to find that she has learned to move with the times and how to make the monarchy more responsive without being trendy. She's always had to have a very delicate balance in the way that she has functioned as monarch. If she seems too remote and too detached from the people, she will lose her connection. But on the other hand, if she seems too much like everybody else, she'll lose her mystique. So she's had this fascinating balancing act.
And in many ways, its core, not to make it a political issue, but in many ways, its core is kind of the essence of British conservatism. I mean, if you look at the writings of Edmund Burke, you see this sense of conservative incrementalism, this ability to stay rooted in the past, but to make changes as required by modernity.
Well, that is exactly right. And she has been very fortunate in that she has been well advised over the years. I've interviewed a number of her top advisors, and at first she was surrounded by all of them aristocratic men. But if you look at the way the household is organized now, and I, in the course of writing this book, I was given the cooperation of Buckingham Palace, and I had a chance to get to interview quite a few of them and to watch them in action. I traveled with her overseas, and for example, her whole press office now is practically, it's run by a bunch of young women, and they're very savvy. They understand the press. They understand the need to respond to changes in communication. I was surprised that the Queen launched the first royal website all the way back in 1997. And she adapted to television, by the way, very early, in 1957. She gave her first live television broadcast, when she was in Canada on a state visit. And her husband, Prince Philip, has been instrumental in helping her modernize. He first taught her how to use a teleprompter in 1957 when she gave her Christmas broadcast on television for the first time. She's far more aware and attuned than people give her credit for, I think.
And even Richard Nixon gave her speech-making advice.
Yes, that was so. Her relationship with the United States is something that no other biographer has particularly been interested in. I was fascinated by it. She's been here 11 times, which is almost as many times as she's been to, say, Australia, which is one of her major realms where she is queen. Her first big visit. She's had five private holidays, but her first big visit was in 1957. And as you say, Richard Nixon gave a lunch for her in the Capitol. And there had been some criticism in Britain about the way she spoke, that she was too staid. And he gave her a book that was about kind of the art of public speaking, which I thought was so amusing. But she's also been so relaxed in this country in all of her visits. In that first visit in 1957, the first big state visit, she, on the spur of the moment, decided to see a supermarket in suburban Maryland. She was on her way to see what she called a football match. It was the University of North Carolina and the University of Maryland football game. And on the way, she spotted a giant supermarket, and she said, "I want to see how American women shop." And so she went. She spent a minute to the absolute astonishment of all the shoppers in there. She wandered around and talked to people and inspected the frozen foods and looked in the shopping carts and saw her first checkout counter. One of the British papers, when they were, they've been reading about all this, when she came back, they said, "Ma'am, why did you have to cross the ocean to be real?"
To what extent did her views about America evolve over time? How are her views now perhaps different than they were in the 1950s?
Well, I think it's probably solidified. She was curious about the United States, obviously, in the 50s. The first time she went to New York City, she wanted to come on a ferry boat. She wanted to see it from the water the way immigrants did, and she actually looked at the skyline of Lower Manhattan, and she said, "Wee!" She was, just exuberant to see it. But she's had relationships with every president since Harry Truman, except Lyndon Johnson, who desperately wanted to meet her, and her sense of this country has been shaped by those relationships and deepened. She had an extremely good working relationship with Ronald Reagan, and also with Mrs. Reagan, who I saw the other day, and she said she'd just gotten a letter from the Queen. And I think she's always appreciated the common values that we have, that despite the fact that we broke off from Britain in the 18th century, that there's a real common heritage, and she appreciates that, and I think she treasures that. Someone I know who worked in the United States Embassy after 9/11 was at St. Paul's Cathedral for the memorial service that the Queen had, and she looked over and she watched the Queen singing all the words to our national anthem.
What about her relationship over the years with various British prime ministers?
Well, that too was really intriguing to me, and I have a lot in the book about it, and it's a kind of extraordinary span of time when you consider that Winston Churchill was her first prime minister, and he was born in the 19th century, and he served in the army of her great-great-grandmother, Queen Victoria. And then her current prime minister, David Cameron, her 12th, was born 3 years after her youngest son, Prince Edward. And in fact, when David Cameron was 8 years old, she got her first glimpse of him when he appeared in a school production of Toad Hall with her youngest son. The prime ministers have weekly audiences with her, and even if they're somewhat skeptical going in, they have all discovered that she is really an invaluable source of wisdom as well as knowledge. When you consider that she has had access to all government documents, intelligence reports, foreign office cables, budget documents, cabinet minutes. She's known every single world leader over the last 60 years, and she has retained it and learned to use it to be a wise sounding board. She doesn't give advice, but she exercises what is known as her right to be consulted, her right to encourage, and the right to warn. So she always asks good questions. And she's had, sometimes she's had warmer relationships with some prime ministers than others. There's always been a lot of speculation about her relationship with Margaret Thatcher, these two very powerful women working together for more than 10 years, which I haven't seen The Iron Lady, but I gather it's completely absent from the movie, which is too bad because they had a real respect for each other. Margaret Thatcher and the Queen are not temperamentally terribly alike. The Queen has a very good sense of humor, and Margaret Thatcher doesn't particularly, and she also had a tendency to talk at the Queen. But the Queen is not a snob at all, and she would not have looked down on the, you know, on the way Margaret Thatcher came up from being a greengrocer's daughter. She would have she admired her intelligence and her achievements, and she has, you know, she has a great capacity to sort of take each of her prime ministers as they come along, and she's very good at establishing a close relationship very quickly.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that she and Margaret Thatcher had this tenuous kind of relationship that you talk about, and yet both the Queen and Margaret Thatcher individually had such great relationships with Ronald Reagan.
Yes. Well, I wouldn't even call it a tenuous relationship. I mean, they both did have very good relationships with Ronald Reagan, who was, you know, I think a very easy person to get along with. And in the case of Margaret Thatcher, she, you know, they obviously shared the same political philosophy. The Queen is very careful not to reveal what she thinks about politics.
How has she succeeded in doing that for so long? I mean, you know, keeping that under wraps for what, for a short period of time is easy, but to do it for 60 years is quite another.
Well, it's great discipline. She, you know, she was brought up to understand. Once her father, King George VI, became king upon the abdication of her uncle, King Edward VIII, she was given a very specific course of study. She was assigned to have a sort of venerable tutor named Sir Henry Martin, and she spent 6 years studying not only history but the British Constitution, which is quite different from ours because it's unwritten. It's an accumulation of laws and unwritten traditions and precedents, and she learned what her limits were as a constitutional monarch, and she understood how important it is to, as a unifying force for the country, to be politically neutral. Occasionally her opinions have slipped through, and I have some of those instances in my book, but it's been very rare.
Talk a little bit about her relationship with Tony Blair.
Well, it started in a most unusual fashion, as many people remember. He was elected in May of 1997, and 2 months later, Princess Diana was killed in that horrible car crash. During that awful week after Diana's death, Tony Blair had a choice. He could have been neutral, or he could have sort of been indifferent, but he chose to try and work with the Queen's top advisors to guide her she was very good at planning the funeral, but to act in such a way that was responsive to this growing public mourning that was building over the course of the week. He didn't talk to her quite as many times as was portrayed in the film The Queen, but he did make an active decision to support the monarchy, and I think that helped them build a relationship. They got on very well.
One of the things that Blair did, and it's unclear to what extent the Queen understood, Blair really understood the sense of loss for the public. I mean, the whole people's princess phrase, and the way he really had a very clear ear for where the public was. To what extent did he have to bring the Queen along on that?
Well, what he said in the beginning was a bit of a double-edged sword, because he did, you're absolutely right, on the one hand, capture the feelings that the people had for Princess Diana, but calling her the people's princess was at the same time, it sort of helped stir up people. He didn't mean to do that, but it sort of encouraged the temptation to make her into an icon a little bit set against the royal family. The Queen's advisors were, in fact, and I talked to quite a few of them who worked on this during that week. They were on their own, very responsive. They planned a highly unusual funeral that went against a lot of aspects of the way royal funerals had been planned. And the Queen, from the very beginning, was very much in favor of that. She made decisions quickly at the beginning of the week. What happened in the middle of the week was the reaction to her decision to stay up in her estate in the Highlands of Scotland. And the reason she did that was sort of paradoxically because she put her family before her duty. If she'd been criticized in the course of her reign, it was for putting her duty first. But she saw these two grandsons of hers, Prince William and Prince Harry, and what a loss they were having. And so they'd gone through. And so she wanted to protect them and comfort them and keep them in a place where they were happy and to prepare them for the ordeal of the public funeral that they were facing that Saturday. But at the same time, the hundreds of thousands of mourners who were flooding into London felt that she was being too remote. So it was in turning her around and getting her to come back to London sooner than she had planned was the one way that Tony Blair did play a role. And he used Prince Charles actually as an intermediary to get her to understand what was going on in London.
In some ways, she had to think that no matter what she did, it was going to be criticized.
Yes, well, exactly. If she had come down too soon, if she'd come down sort of immediately, everybody would have said, well, what are you doing? Why are you abandoning your grandsons up in Scotland? So it was, in a way, it was a sort of lose-lose situation for her. But she rebounded really well because she did several things that were significant symbolically. First of all, when she and Philip arrived at Buckingham Palace on Friday morning before Princess Diana's funeral the next day, they stopped in front of Buckingham Palace and got out and looked at the incredible display of flowers and mementos that had been piled up on the railings. And the Queen walked along a line of women mourners and spoke to them in a very compassionate way. And I think that kind of lowered the temperature immediately. People saw that she was being responsive. That evening she gave a very compassionate speech, a live speech, with the windows open in Buckingham Palace, and you could hear the ambient noise of the millions, actually, by then, in the crowd. And she was very authentic in that speech. She was very clear about what she wanted to say. It was perfect pitch. With a little hint of emotion, she said what she meant. It was straightforward. It wasn't gushy. It was authentic, which the Queen is. She doesn't say any more or less than what she means. Then, the following day, as the funeral cortege was going past Buckingham Palace, instead of what she might have done in earlier times, which was to stand with her family on the balcony and watch it go past, she asked everybody to come down to the gates of Buckingham Palace with her. And as Diana's coffin went by, she bowed. And that also was a very significant symbolic moment. The public opinion polls had been trending against her in the earlier part of the week. She's had an extraordinary approval rating of about 80% ever since they first started taking those polls back in 1969. And during that week, it sort of started to drop down to about 75%. But by the end of the week, after her speech and after the funeral, she had bounced back again.
Talk about the relationship with her grandsons, particularly with Prince William, who she's shown a particular interest in his role as a future king.
Yes, she has. She's taken a very active role, really, with all of her grandchildren, but obviously with Prince William, since he is the second in line to the throne after Prince Charles. He went to school, as did Harry, at Eton, which is right down the road from Windsor Castle, where she does spend a lot of time. And she made a point of frequently inviting the two grandsons, William in particular, up to the castle for tea. She has not only instructed them in what it means to be a constitutional monarch, but she's also led by example, which William himself has spoken about in a number of interviews. more recently, she took, I thought this was fascinating, that it was she, not Charles, who hired a very experienced and wise veteran of the British Foreign Service, Sir David Manning, who had been British ambassador in a number of countries, including the United States, to be a kind of tutor and mentor to William and Harry and now Kate. And David Manning has accompanied William on his two trips to Australia in the past several years. He also was with William and Kate when they came to Canada and to California last year. And as far as I can tell, by the way they've been conducting themselves, he's given them very good advice and they've taken it.
How does she see the role of the monarchy today, and is that any different from the way she viewed it when she became queen?
Well, I think she sees the role of the monarch as a figure, more than a figure. I mean, she's more than a figurehead, but someone who must be a unifying force, who has to operate above politics and partisanship and unite the country, and also to be responsive to the people. She takes that very seriously. She always has, not only through her constant travels around the United Kingdom. One of her private secretary to both Margaret Thatcher and John Major told me that she knows every inch of the United Kingdom in a way that nobody else does, and she makes it a point to understand what people's concerns are by talking to them and also by paying very close attention to the correspondence that she receives and goes through every day. So I think probably, if anything, her knowledge of the country is much deeper. She understands what the problems of the people are and how they have changed over time. She's also become more appreciative of the fact that it's not the homogeneous country that it was when she first became queen. During her golden jubilee, she made that was 10 years ago. She's now having her diamond starting on Monday. But she made a point of going to a Hindu temple and, a synagogue and a mosque to show her appreciation of the multicultural and multi-faith world that we live in. Those were symbolic, but they were very important.
She also does seem to have a sense, you mentioned how early on she created the website for the royal family, she does have a sense of the world getting smaller, of the world being more connected.
Yes, well, she, as you say, well, as I mentioned, she's very, been very, she's really given an emphasis to connecting the royal family and the monarchy to a wider interconnected world. She not only has the website, but there's a YouTube channel. She has a Facebook page that I think got something like 300,000 likes within the first month or so. She doesn't tweet, but they have a Twitter account. This is something that they're very aware of. They understand the power of social media to bring people together, to communicate, and she has been very much behind this. She's almost 86 years old. She's about two decades beyond the time most people retire, and she works very hard.
And why hasn't she retired, or some would say abdicated? And talk about that and her relationship with Charles.
Well, she hasn't retired for a very simple reason, which is that it's a job for life. When she became queen, she took a vow. She was really chosen. I mean, she was chosen by God. In effect, she was consecrated with holy oil, and she took a vow to serve to the end of her life. She has said over and over that it is a job for life to serve her people. So, it's not an issue with her. But, and she said, one of her cousins told me that they had talked about it once, and she said, well, I wouldn't abdicate. But if I became incapacitated with Alzheimer's disease or a stroke, that at that point she wouldn't step aside. Her son would take over as Prince Regent. Mm-hmm. And he has been waiting patiently longer than any other Prince of Wales, any other heir to the throne in history. King Edward VII was 59 when Queen Victoria died. Prince Charles will turn 64 in his mother's Diamond Jubilee year this year. It's conceivable he could be, we could wait another 10 years because she really believes that it is her duty, and she's obligated to carry on. As she said to one of her former Archbishops of Canterbury, George Carey, when he told her that he was going to retire a number of years ago, she said, "That's something I can't do. I'm going to carry on to the end."
And talk about the relationship between her and Charles.
Well, it's had its rocky moments, mm-hmm. but I suppose the one criticism of her might be that she did, particularly in the early years when she was establishing herself and proving herself to be a worthy monarch, that she was a somewhat distant mother, and she gave a lot of the responsibility for making decisions about her children to Prince Philip, who was a bit of a tough taskmaster, particularly when it came to Charles, who is a sensitive character and probably was sent to the wrong school. And certainly during the turbulence of his marriage to Diana, he had difficulty talking to his parents about what was happening and how it was falling apart. But in the years since Diana's death, he has gotten closer to both of his parents, I would say. And he has been, I think, gratified that they have publicly expressed their approval of what he has done as Prince of Wales. There was that movie and play, The Madness mm-hmm. of George III, where somebody said being Prince of Wales is in a position, it's a predicament. He's made it into a real job. He has many causes that he espouses, and he has the, of course, in his position, he has the latitude to choose what he will get involved with and where he will become an advocate. As monarch, and this will be a challenge for him, because all monarchs have to really operate on the advice of others. That will be a difficult transition for him, and I have quite a bit in the book about how people think he will adapt to that. But he and his mother, it's not probably a cozy relationship, but that's mainly because the family, the royal family, is almost set up as a sort of business.
Mm-hmm.
They call it the royal firm. But within that, they obviously love each other, and there is affection, but it's also, they're all a bunch of professionals, too.
What about all the talk we often hear, were it even possible, to skip Charles and Prince William to become the next monarch?
Well, I think nothing is impossible. It would mean that Charles would have to take the throne and then abdicate, which is a very touchy concept for the royal family after Edward VIII abdicated back in 1936. however, if Charles were to abdicate, then a law would have to be passed by Parliament, and all the parliaments of the 15 realms where the British monarch is recognized as their, in his case it would be king, he would lose his titles of Prince of Wales and Duke of Cornwall, which are reserved for the monarch's eldest son. And he would also lose all the revenues that he gets, which are considerable, from the Duchy of Cornwall. Something could probably be worked out in that regard, but it would be complicated. And any change in the succession could also tip countries like Australia and New Zealand and Canada into giving up the British sovereign entirely as mm-hmm. their head of state and becoming republics. So it could create some instability.
More interestingly, why is there constantly talk about this? Is it just idle chatter, or is there some reason why this conversation keeps coming up?
Well, I think the reason is all you have to do is look at Prince William and now the Duchess of Cambridge, Catherine. David Cameron called them the team of the future. The Queen has taken a great interest in William because she understands that the future of the monarchy, which requires the consent of the people, rests on getting younger people to believe in the monarchy and all of its values. There's a saying that to be a successful monarch, you have to be young and beautiful or old and venerable, and the Queen has managed to be both. Charles, whenever he becomes king, will only have an opportunity to be old and venerable. But I think it's inevitable that as people look at William and Kate, they, you know, many, many opinion polls have indicated that there is popular sentiment for them to become king and queen. It's unfortunate for Charles because he is sort of thrust in the middle of this, and he's spent so much time earnestly trying to do a good job. So I guess it's just an inevitable reaction to these young and beautiful and quite dedicated already Duchess and Duke, and people, you know, have a natural affinity toward them. I think William, because he is half Spencer, he's not only a Windsor, but he comes, you know, he's half Diana, and I think people also project Diana onto William and see qualities in him that reflect what they admired in Diana. He's quite down to earth, he has a good sense of humor, and he also has that real sense of Windsor dedication.
Right. There's also a sense that the Queen learned something about youthfulness and about popularity and about celebrity culture as a result of the Diana experience, and that there's a sense that she sees that can be used, perhaps through William, for the benefit of the monarchy.
Well, I think that's a very insightful observation. What she said in her speech on the eve of Diana's funeral was that there were lessons to be learned from the way Diana lived and the way Diana died. And in the following years, the monarchy, which has always, you know, has always been attuned to adapting to changing times, probably accelerated that a bit. They hired, for the first time, a public opinion pollster who did surveys for them. They were very concerned that they were being perceived as too inward-looking and too out of touch. And they took the results of this polling, and there were even some focus groups, and they adapted kind of their style of interacting with people. Previously, the Queen might have come to visit a school and stood in the doorway and waved to the children. Now she's much more inclined to come in and sit down and talk to them. Little things like that, but they make a difference and people appreciate them.
Sally Bedell Smith. The book is Elizabeth the Queen, The Life of a Modern Monarch, just out from Random House. Sally, it is always a pleasure. I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.